I'm Bex, and welcome to the Week Junior Show. Today, I'm joined by three of the team from the Week Junior, the magazine making sense of the world for 8 to 14-year-olds. We've got managing editor Vanessa.
Hello.
Writer Flora.
Hello.
And assistant editor of the Week Junior's Science and Nature magazine, Kieran.
Hello.
This week, we'll be talking about the Tokyo Olympic Games, how two teenagers found four hidden planets, and the brand new banknote. Plus, we'll have a debate all about history. But before all of that, given we'll be talking about life in the past for our debate, I wanted to know what historical era you would most like to have lived in. Vanessa, I will let you go first.
I think I'd like the 1920s, as long as I was rich. Because the partying and the fun after the Spanish flu epidemic was quite something. And the financial crash that happened in 1929 and really put the world into recession hadn't happened yet. So I want the party time, please.
All right, you want that sweet spot in the mid-20s. I'll do it for you. Good idea. Flora, how about you?
Well, mine is also predicated on being rich because I like hunting for antiques, things like furniture and jewellery. And I always like finding stuff from the Georgian period. So I'd like to live in that time and surround myself with beautiful things.
Oh, an interesting era to pick. And I respect that. Kieran, what have you picked?
I've picked the hat trick of only if I'm rich, I would like to live in ancient Egypt, because I've been learning a bit about that recently. And it's absolutely fascinating. And what a period of time to call home.
Well, I was going to joke with you all and say, oh, I've chosen to be a caveman. Absolutely not. I also wanted to be rich. In the Victorian era, I think it would be quite... I've always been obsessed with the Victorians, so I think it would be very fun to live in a lovely stately home and just to have lots of money. So we're all going to be rich when we go time travelling. Good to know. I want to know what is everybody's favourite fact from this week as well. Vanessa, what have you learnt?
Well, I found out that last year there were 351 million £50 notes in circulation, which, to give you an idea, is out of nearly 4 billion notes in total. And not one of those 351 million passed through my hands. I have to say that second bit is not my favourite fact.
No, not your favourite fact at all. That is a lot of £50 notes in circulation. I have, like you, Vanessa, not really seen any of them. Flora, what have you found out about?
I learnt about the meaning of the word respair, which is a word from the 16th century, so earlier than the Georgian period. And it basically means the opposite of despair. So it's about fresh hope or recovery from despair. And I just think it's a really great Easter word. And it's kind of gone out of fashion, but I think we can revive it.
I will be using that in my day-to-day language. Thank you, Flora, for bringing that to my life. And Kieran, what fact have you brought to the table?
My fact is sort of related to ancient Egypt, and it is the fact that mummies are more than 2,000 years older than the ancient Egyptian civilization. We often think of mummies just as being an ancient Egypt thing, but in fact, the Chinchorro people used mummification for millennia before the Egyptians ever did.
Wow, I did not know that. Well, three classic facts, guys. Thank you very much for those. And now, speaking of facts, it's time for real or rubbish. Now, this is where I hear a story from a lovely person from the Week Junior, and I have to figure out whether it is real or whether it is rubbish. Anna, whose turn is it today?
It's my turn, my debut on Real or Rubbish.
Yeah, all right, go for it.
Okay, so as I'm sure that most of us know, 12th of April is a very important date. It's the date the government has provisionally set for shops, pubs, hairdressers and restaurants to reopen in the UK. However, with restaurants, people can only eat outside, which might not be all that great in the UK with our weather. But this rule has prompted one pie restaurant in the town of Winchester called Pie Caramba, that's not the real rubbish, to become the first ever one-table restaurant. So on the small patch of pavement outside the premises of Pie Caramba, there's only one space for a solitary table. And apparently the bookings are coming in thick and fast, with customers asking for the table. So is this set to become the most exclusive, hottest pie restaurant in town, or is the whole story just a lonely lie?
Oh my goodness, if it's true, that would be my worst nightmare. I would hate sitting on that table so much, because I like... first of all, sitting on my own outside of it would, oh my goodness, that you can probably tell from the way I'm babbling, that stresses me out so much. Just the one that, and they've got no room for tables outside. Do they have tables inside? That's not the only table, right?
Well, they can't operate tables inside because of the rules.
So they've decided to properly reopen the whole restaurant for the sake of one table.
Exactly. I mean, imagine the overheads.
Yeah.
They're going to have to pay staff. They're going to have to pay the chef.
Think
they're
of
gonna
the pastry.
They're going to have to pay the street cleaner who has to clean around the table.
That's...
All the crumbs.
How many crumbs are
Someone
we thinking?
Someone to scare off the pigeons. You know, there's a lot of overheads there.
There's more people.
Is it really
sit?
Worth it just for one table?
And do we think? Do we know how many people fit around the table? Did you say
two.
That? Two. Right. Okay. So there's two.
I
people.
I didn't say that, but that's an extra data point which you do need.
Okay.
Two people can sit.
Because that seems that's even worse. Two people. If it was a table for six, all right. Fine.
Are you expecting King Arthur's round table here?
Right, if you've not read your copy of the magazine yet, have a little think to yourself. Feel free to make your guess, and then we can find out together what the answer is at the end of the show. Now it's time for our three big stories from this week. Vanessa, what's your favourite story from this week?
Well, I'm talking about the £50 note again. But first, I'd like to make two things clear, since that was my favourite fact. One, that I'm not money obsessed. And that two, that Kieran and I have, in fact, each read more than one story in this week's issues. He's right, talking about ancient Egypt. Now, Bex, do you know who is on the £5, the £10 or the £20 polymer note?
Is Jane Austen there somewhere?
Correct. She's on the tenner.
Yes.
No, the other
and
two.
And then I feel like Darwin may at some point have been on some note, maybe.
Gosh, you're better at this than I did. I only knew this when I actually read the story. Well, I'll tell you. Churchill's on the fiver. Jane
right.
Austen's on the tenner, as you guessed uh-huh. correctly. And the artist Turner is on the £20 note. But what are the £50 note? Well, the Bank of England has just revealed who will appear, and it's the brilliant mathematician Alan Turing.
All right, so how have they come to this decision? Who decides, how do they decide who gets to go on a banknote?
Well, appropriate enough, it's the Bank of England that chooses. And it says, and I'm reading this from its website, it looks for UK characters who've made an important contribution to our society and culture through their innovation, leadership or values. We do not include fictional characters or people who are still living, except the monarch on the front of the note. And in 2014, the bank changed its method of choosing banknote characters. And there's a special committee that decides which field they want to represent. Then they get experts in that field to join the committee. And then they invite the public to nominate people within that field. And 2015 was the first time they used the new method. And that's when they chose J.M.W. Turner on the new £20 note. In the hunt for Turing, in 2018, the bank went through the same method and got a tantalising 227,299 nominations. And from that, the committee chose Alan Turing. Now, once the person's been chosen, because they so that all happened in 2018, once the person has been chosen, it takes a while for the note to be made because it has to be designed and they use really complicated patterns and they include various security features. So the note is very difficult to forge. In other words, criminals can't make illegal copies of its notes. So why did they choose Alan Turing? Well, he's most famous for inventing the machine that broke the Enigma code, which was the apparently uncrackable code used by the Nazis during the Second World War. And Turing worked at a place called Bletchley Park, which is a large country house, where the British government and intelligence services brought together the most brilliant minds in the country to work together and give the Allies a way to beat the Nazis and bring the war to a close. Turing and his colleagues succeeded and cracked the code, shortening the war and saving possibly millions of lives. But he was not honoured during his lifetime. There were several reasons for this. He was gay, which means he was attracted to other men, which was illegal at the time. Plus, the work done at Bletchley stayed a state secret for decades. In fact, the full story only came out in 1996. But he didn't just work on code cracking, though. He was so brilliant that he was the first person to realise the potential for artificial intelligence, which is a computer that can do things that usually require human intelligence, such as learning from its mistakes and trying a new method. And Turing devised a test that could tell how close to human intelligence a computer has developed. So the test involves a person to ask questions hidden from a computer and another human. The questioner asks written questions and the human and the computer each write an answer back. And after a few goes, the questioner has to guess which is the computer or which is the human. In the beginning, computers wrote gobbledygook, so it wasn't particularly difficult. But now computers are much more sophisticated. And if the questioner can't tell them apart, the computer passes the Turing test, as it's called. And so you can see from this that Turing's work had an immense, if pretty much unsung, effect on mid-20th century life. And now, as we move into the era of AI, his work is still shaping our world. And I think that deserves a bit of recognition.
This is amazing.
And by the way, the note goes into circulation on the 23rd of June. But going on last year's performance, I'm not expecting to see one in real life.
I was going to say, if I see a £50 note, I will marvel at it for two reasons now. One, the fact I have a £50 note, and two, the fact it's Alan Turing. I didn't know all of that stuff about him. That's awesome.
He's a really, really interesting character. So, you know, well done us for finally recognising it.
And Vanessa, just between you and me, I know you're not meant to pick people who are real living people to go on the note, but if you could pick one person from the Week Junior team to go on a banknote, who would you pick?
Me. It's obvious. I don't need a Bank of England committee to sit. I don't need to ask members of the public. No, it's me every time.
Did not think you were going to say that. I can't believe I fell for that. Of course you're going to pick yourself. Right, Flora, tell me, what have you been finding out about this week?
I have been finding out about the Olympic torch relay in Japan, which began on the 25th of March. On that date, the Olympic torch began its journey around Japan, where the Olympics Games will kick off with the opening ceremony on the 23rd of July. The flame sits inside an aluminium cone, and it was lit in Greece last year. Greece was the ancient birthplace of the Olympics. The flame was then transported to Greece on a special plane and kept burning in a security lamp, a bit like a miner's lamp. And then there was a ceremony in Fukushima in Japan on the 25th of March, and now the torch is being carried across Japan by a total of 10,000 runners before the Olympics begin. And former players from Japan's women's football team started the torch relay, and they pass it on every few miles. And the games were due to take place in 2020, but they had to be postponed due to coronavirus, COVID-19. And on the 20th of March this year, it was announced that no international fans can go to the games, unfortunately, because of the COVID rules. But at least we can all watch from TV at home.
I have got to say, can you imagine the pressure of carrying that torch? I would be terrified of dropping it or of it just going out.
I know. I was trying to find out how heavy it is and all these kind of things. I mean, you know, it's pretty hard to carry something while running.
I mean, it's hard to just run in general.
And most of these... Yeah, it's hard to run in general. And most of the 10,000 runners, they're not sort of professional runners. They're just people from the public.
Oh, my goodness. Flora, I have to ask, if you could compete in any Olympic sport, which one do you think you'd have the best chance at doing well at?
Gosh.
Everybody secretly thinks they're good at
one. Do
you
know what? Well, I was about to say, I actually secretly... Well, not even that secretly. I'd say this publicly, that I was once in the trampolining team at school. It was the only team I was in. I had a leotard and everything, and then you know, this is when I was like 16. It wasn't sort of a very young thing, and I remember getting up onto the trampoline, starting my routine, doing the first manoeuvre, and I was all ready to do my backflips and everything else, and then I just completely forgot my whole routine as all these people were looking at me. So I don't think I'd get very far.
Wow, we've relived a memory there. Sorry for bringing that up, Flora. Yeah. But
I'd actually forgotten that until you just asked me.
Well, if I ever see you on the Olympic gymnastics team, I will hold my breath. Kieran, exactly. What have you been finding out about this week?
I learnt this week that two teenagers from the US have discovered a brand new solar system that we didn't know about before. And in the solar system, there are four exoplanets. And exoplanets are planets of any kind that exist outside our own solar system. And these four new worlds that they've found are orbiting a star which has the very catchy name of HD 108236.
Mm. Yeah.
I know that's going to be stuck in your head for the rest of the day now. So this star is like our sun. It's very similar in size and in brightness, but it's 200 light years away from us. So that means that any light travelling from that star towards us will take 200 Earth years to get here. So in other words, it's ages away. It's around 5.9 trillion miles from Earth. So how do you even begin to find planets that are that far away? Well, that's what the high school students, who are called Jasmine Wright and Kartik Pingley, they made the discovery during a space program in the US. So they were looking at data that's collected by a space telescope called TESS, or the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And TESS looks at tiny dips in the brightness of stars, and it recognizes if that dip is being caused by a planet orbiting in front of the star. And that event, a planet passing in front of a star, is called a transit, hence the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And by studying light from HD 108236, mm-hmm. sounds like a radio station, the two students spotted not just one, but four of these dips, which reveals, of course, that there are four different exoplanets orbiting it. Three of them are most close to our Neptune, but they're smaller, so they're gassy planets. And the fourth is a rocky super-Earth, meaning it's bigger than our home planet, but there's not really any chance of us finding life there because they just orbit too close to their star for any life to survive.
So tell me, how long have we known about exoplanets?
Well, the first ones that we found for sure, they were discovered in the 1990s, although we sort of knew that they existed before that. We just hadn't got the evidence for it. And of course, one of the new challenges of finding exoplanets is that you have to work out what you're going to call them, because you've got to give them catchy names, and you've got to make sure that they follow a rule that everyone on Earth calls it the same thing. So you now have a system where a lot of exoplanets have their official names, which are usually fairly standard things like HD 108236, and then they have their nicknames, which is where the scientists have a bit of fun. So there are real planets out there in the universe now that are named after fictional ones, for example. So there's Tatooine from Star Wars is out there, and the Forbidden Planet is a nickname for another, which comes from a 1950s science fiction film. And so what will happen with those four planets that Jasmine and Kartik found is that they will now go through an official process to get their proper names to make sure that we all know what they're called.
Oh, amazing. And can you give me that very catchy name again?
HD 108236.
Oh my goodness. Wow, it rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Brilliant. Thank you very much, Kieran, for that. Now it's time for the big debate. So this week we're asking whether life was better in the past. Well, I'm intrigued about this. Who can tell me a little bit more?
I can tell you a lot about this. So a recent book by Samantha Holland, who is a senior researcher at Leeds Beckett University, found that the desire for all things vintage is increasing in modern society. And the term vintage means something from the past that is of a high quality, particularly if it's described as being the best of its kind. So Holland found that there's been a growing interest in the fashion and lifestyles that were typical of the 1940s, 1950s and 1960s, particularly around how people are dressing and how they decorate their home. And of course, during lockdown over the past year, lots of people have taken up traditionally old-fashioned hobbies and crafts like making bread, crochet, knitting, that kind of thing. So we want to know whether life in the past is better than it is today.
Okay then, well, it's going to be Flora versus Vanessa. Guys, you have one minute each, but I'm sure you know that by now. I do feel that I have to remind you every week though, just in case. First up, it's going to be Flora. She is arguing why life was better in the past. So Flora, whenever you're ready, take it away.
For some people, lockdown has been a truly blissful year, staying at home, baking things, growing things, and generally nurturing life on a smaller, more slow scale. We've flown abroad less, we've saved money, we've got to know our neighbours. And this way of life is less stressful. It's actually richer, ironically. And it's also an echo of a previous time when people knew how to live well with less. Compared to now, when the average family spends 21 minutes over supper. There is so much pressure to work hard and make enough money to be able to afford, what, a more expensive holiday, a bigger TV, more meals out, maybe at Pycarumba. Living with less and being content with less, as they did back in the day, makes people more creative, as we have to find ways to entertain ourselves without all the obvious modern inventions like TV. And as a result, people were more creative, better connected to their community, and more content.
Oh, lovely stuff. Thank you. That you took me by surprise there, because that was an early finish from Flora. So, Vanessa, it's time to say why you disagree. Whenever you're ready, take it away.
Okay, well, when I say now is best, I would like to nudge that to any time after the 12th of April, which, as Flora mentioned, is when hairdressers reopen, because I have been cutting my own hair with kitchen scissors, and now I look like a rag doll. But anyway, wait. Oh, yeah, present or past. Okay, I certainly look back fondly to the past because things seemed more certain then. But is that really the case? We think they felt more certain because we know what happened next. At the time, I'm pretty sure they didn't feel certain at all. It said that people were kinder and more friendly. Is that true? I doubt it. Human nature doesn't really change that much. And in the past, there was still capital punishment and children were beaten when they did wrong. That doesn't sound very kind at all. Finally, though, and this for me is the clincher, that however marvellous the past seems, the one reason I wouldn't go back is pain relief. Going to the dentist, having a baby, recovering from surgery, sorting out a bad back, life is far more comfortable now than it was in the past. So for me, I love looking through photos of time gone by, but now is where I'd rather be.
Wow, I genuinely thought you were going to go over a minute there because of your lovely hairdresser mention, but you didn't, you were spot on. I'm so impressed. Right, Kieran, what do you reckon?
I mean, we've never experienced the past, have we, Bex? Particularly being so youthful as we are.
Sure.
But I'm going to stick with what I know, I think. I think present is better because we get all the benefits of ye olde days. We get to do all the traditional activities. We can wear traditional clothes. We can get nice things for our houses. But we also get the benefits of modern medicine and the luxuries that come with that. So I think I'm going to stick with present day being better than the past.
Interesting.
But can I just say, it just sort of shades it, because only this morning I bought a very old-fashioned type of marmalade for my breakfast. And it was a Frank Cooper's Oxford cut, absolutely delicious. And so Flora, I mean, my heart is really with you. My heart is with Flora, my head is in the present.
Interesting. I have to say, I was with Flora until... you mentioned in your debate, Vanessa, about how we... you think... It was everybody knew everything then, but of course nobody was as sure then of what was going to happen. We just know it because we're in the future now.
So
that was a very good point. I'll be interested to know what the listeners reckon on this one. Maybe they have a specific time they think would be really fun to live in, like we mentioned at the beginning of the show. So if you do, let us know. Go and respond to the poll right now at theweekjunior.co.uk/polls or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk with a video of you explaining what side of the debate you support and why. We may just play that video out on the show. You will be famous. Now, last week on the podcast, we debated whether digital art is the future. I have thought about this debate many times through the last week, honestly. In our poll, 68% of you said no, you prefer traditional art forms, and 32% of you thought that digital creations were the way forward. So here are some of your comments.
Noor, age 10, emailed to say, despite the convenience of NFTs, that's non-fungible tokens, which are one-of-a-kind items that prove that you own the digital artwork on your computer, I prefer traditional art because it's amazing to see a Renaissance painting and think that every stroke was painted centuries ago. And paintings can't produce greenhouse gases like a network of constantly running computers do.
Emma told us, I think digital art is not the future because if it damages the environment, then it would have a bad impact on the world. But it could be the future if you are thinking about creating art that can't be stolen.
Xanthi sent us this video explaining why digital artwork isn't the future.
Hi, I'm Xanthi and I'm 10 years old. I think, no, digital artwork wouldn't be the same as actually having the painting in front of you. You wouldn't hang your laptop on the wall for everybody to see, but with physical art, you could hang it anywhere. £50 million is a huge amount of money just to be sent a JPEG file. And anyway, you could find something perfectly fine on Google. Thank you.
And on Apple Podcasts, one listener told us, I think that digital art is okay, but I think we should still keep normal art. If you change to digital after you've made a painting at school, you don't want that to be digital and get your parents to download it. You want it hanging up in your room. Also, painters like Bob Ross might have to quit their jobs.
Oh, good work. I mean, that's so many great opinions there. I love it so much. Remember, this is your chance to get involved. So grab a grown-up and record a video telling us what you think of this week's debate. Then send it in to us at hello@theweekjunior.co.uk and we could play it out on next week's show. Now, Kieran, I hear you've been busy with a brand new podcast. Is that right?
I have, yes. The Week Junior Science and Nature magazine is following in the stead of The Week Junior by launching a podcast this week. So it's been myself and Dan, who's been on a couple of episodes of The Week Junior show, who have been joined by expert guests to help us uncover some mysteries of science. And our first episode is out already. You can take a listen to it by searching for Mysteries of Science wherever you're listening to this podcast. And in that episode, we are investigating the mystery of the Loch Ness Monster. And we are joined by a brilliant children's author called Larry Don, who has done a lot of research into Scotland's mythological creatures and how the traditions of those stories have been handed down through generations, and two real-life monster hunters who are busy trying to track down the monster. And in fact, one of them even tells us of a mysterious encounter they had on Loch Ness.
Oh, that sounds amazing. And you can tell it's legit because you can actually pronounce the word loch properly.
I did a lot of practice, wanted to make sure I got it absolutely right, and here we are.
So we can find that wherever it is we get our podcast, right?
Absolutely. So you can get it on Apple Podcasts, you can get it on Spotify, wherever you're listening to this, and of course, the Fun Kids website as well.
Brilliant stuff. Thanks, Kieran. Now, before we go, it's time to talk about real or rubbish. Flora, can you remind me about it again, please?
Yeah. So this is the story about Pie Caramba, a restaurant in Winchester, opening the table, which is one table for two people outside their premises on the 12th of April. Bookings coming in thick and fast. Is the story real or rubbish?
Well, okay, here's my thinking. They're going to have a quick turnover on the table to make sure they have... You know, you can't just have one person there from 7 till 10. It'll have to be, like, in 20-minute spots to get any kind of money in, right?
Yeah, it's not going to be romantic.
No, it's going to be in, out, what pie do you want? Good, go. But also, I don't know whether they're doing takeaways, because if they're doing takeaways, they've got a reason to stay open. That could be another issue that we...
That is a good point.
Yeah, we haven't addressed that issue. But the table... I mean, maybe they've just gone to IKEA and they've seen a nice table and they thought we've got to use it for something. We've all been there. Obviously, we've all been there. I am going to say, because I like the idea of something just being called the table, I'm going to say this is real. I'm going to put it out there. And I don't know what, I mean, even as I said that out loud, it feels ridiculous, but I'm going to say it's a real story. I'm going to do it. Yeah. Yeah.
So drum roll, please. It's real.
Yes. Oh my god! So they have just that one table.
So get down to Pie Caramba, Bex.
Pie Caramba. Oh my, yeah.
But earlier, book it now because it's genuinely booked. Apparently, it's an incredibly successful restaurant, and they've got a few chains around the south of England, and everyone loves their pies. And maybe they're just doing a good service to their customers. I don't know about takeaway. I'm sure they are doing takeaways.
It was only when the idea of takeaways came to me that I was like, maybe it is real, because I thought otherwise you're just not going to open for one table, are you? That would be ridiculous.
Yeah, that would be crazy.
Oh, the pigeon scare.
That would be the most... Can you imagine how expensive the pie would be?
£42 for a chicken pie, please. Well, that is it for the Week Junior Show this week. So goodbye to Vanessa.
Goodbye.
To Flora.
Goodbye.
And Kieran.
Goodbye.
Remember, you can drop us a comment on PopJam at The Week Junior or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk. And don't forget to rate, review and subscribe or follow us wherever it is you get this podcast. Bye!
If you want to get your hands on a copy of The Week Junior magazine, we're offering a 6-week free trial. To get yours, head over to dennismags.co.uk/The Week Junior and use the code PODCAST.